Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
Critical race theory is not saying that America is racist because there were racist laws. It's saying that there were racist laws because America's racist. Racism is the soil of America.
If you don't have patriarchy, it doesn't mean that you escape the rule of men. You just have androarchy. That is, you have men who don't care about you at all.
We must remain steady in the word and in the strength that God provides us day by day. That is where the future for us lies, whatever comes.
What they're talking about is justification in two different realms. Paul is talking about justification before God. James is talking about justification before men.
This is the world headquarters for JSM in Ponca City, Oklahoma, and we love to listen to Issues Etc. while perking our favorite brew, Craig's Covenant Coffee.
Well, consider this question. How has the decline of the family and religious commitments led to the rise of political identity? People who identify themselves first and foremost, and in some cases perhaps only, by their political affiliations or their ideas or their party. What are teachers seeing in the classroom today that should concern us about the students' generation and the future of not only America, but Western civilization? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, August the 4th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about Western civilization and American students with Jeremy Adams, author of the new book, Hollowed Out, A Warning About America's Next Generation. Pastor Brian Wolf Miller will join us for part 12 of our series, What I Wish I Knew My Non-Lutheran Family Knew About. Today, the subject is the Bible. And then Terry Mattingly of Get Religion will be alongside to discuss a Washington Post story about an anti-mask evangelical pastor. The headline reads, Evangelical pastor demands churchgoers ditch their masks. Quote, don't believe this Delta variant nonsense. Joining us to discuss Western civilization and American students, Jeremy Adams. He's a high school and college teacher. In 2018, he was the first classroom teacher inducted into the California State University Hall of Fame, and he's author of the new book, Hollowed Out, A Warning About America's Next Generation. Jeremy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
You say that teachers have a front row seat to America's decline. What are teachers seeing in their classrooms that should concern all of us?
Well, I've been teaching for 23 years now, and I've noticed in the last 5 to 10 years, and I'm not alone, the book Hollowed Out came about not just because of my observations, but because I found that what was happening in my classroom was happening in almost all the classrooms of my colleagues and in the broader country. And what we're noticing is that in the last 5 to 10 years, a lot of young people spend their time in very different ways, and that time dictates that they're being brought up in an era where they are untethered to adult values, adult expectations, most of all, adult role models. Many of our young people before the pandemic, Todd, were spending 9 or 10 hours a day on their devices, which means a lot of the good stuff of childhood is being displaced for device time. They aren't dating the way that they used to. They aren't reading the way they have in ages past. They aren't going to movies. They aren't going to football games. Their knowledge of religion, it's not just that they're not religious. They don't know much about religion. They aren't dating. Half of all 18 to 35-year-olds don't have a romantic partner. The desire for marriage and family is in free fall. They are a very lonely, lonely generation. 1 in 5 millennials say they don't have a good friend in the entire world. And so these things that fill in the soul, that fill in your life, that make it substantive, are not there. So they're being hollowed out.
How do you respond to someone who says that this disengagement, this isolation, and what you call radical individualism that we see in school-age children is just a normal generational phenomenon? They'll outgrow it. How do you respond?
You know, that's a great question. And you know, when you write a book like this, you kind of wonder, well, what's going to be the knock? What are people going to say about it? And they're going to say that, well, you know, every generation of older Americans looks at the youth and think the world's going downhill. But I would say that that's not correct. This is not normal. There are a few things that are unique. Most of all, look at our young people and how they feel about their own lives. Their mental health is in crisis. You look at the spike in self-harm from 2012 to 2017. It went up by over 63%. You look at suicide in 10 to 24-year-olds. That's gone up over 50%. The word that my colleagues and I hear all the time from young people is anxiety. The fact that they're living in their rooms, they're isolated, they're staring at screens all day, they don't have a lot of friends, and what they do want for their lives is something that's not traditional. They, in many ways, they want to be cut off. They don't want to make traditional commitments the way that people have in the past. And so this is not a normal phenomenon. It's not normal in the way they spend their time. It's not normal in the way they're being socialized. It's not normal in the way they're absorbing values or a lack of values. So anybody who says that this is a normal generation isn't spending any time with these young people, sadly.
So how is the young man who spends his time gaming, and sometimes well out of their teens and into their 20s, how is that emblematic of what you called that hollowed out self?
There is nothing wrong with gaming. There's absolutely nothing wrong with getting on and gaming and hanging out with your friends. So I don't want anybody to think that I have anything against gaming. Where I become worried, and where you see this in a lot of young men in their early 20s, is the problem is when it displaces other things. It's when instead of traveling, instead of dating, instead of going out, instead of reading books, you see this monomaniacal obsession with gaming hour after hour after hour. There was a fascinating story I read recently about a group of young doctors in their 30s who weren't married. And what they used to do is they used to kind of get the younger doctors and would take them out, you know, and say, we're going to take a trip on our 1 week vacation here or there. What they learned was a lot of the younger doctors planned on spending their entire week in their house by themselves gaming, which is displacing travel, displacing meeting new people and trying new things. You even have something like 15%, I believe in the book I put this, almost 15% of all divorces, the women will say, our husbands were more interested in the gaming than they were the marriage or the children. So my worry is when it's that much of a priority, when you're focused on having fun rather than cultivating relationships and values that tend to nourish, you know, who you are and your sense of well-being, that's what leads to a hollowed out life.
How has technology contributed to the infantilization of the younger generation?
Well, this is where I talk about the fact that, you know, young people aren't around adults like they used to, especially in the last 16 months. I mean, it used to be that, you know, you were at home with mom or mom and dad, and you'd go to school and the teachers would be in charge. But nowadays, young people spend their lives staring at videos and social media, watching the content of other children. They haven't been to school for the last 16 months. And let me just tell you, you know, when you ask students, well, when you were on the other side of those Zoom calls all year and you had your camera turned off, were you sitting at a desk taking notes like normal? And they would tell you, absolutely not. We were in bed. We were wearing pajamas. We were texting and watching Netflix when class was going on. We took every advantage to turn work in late. And so this kind of technology has empowered a lot of young people to create a space where adults can't view them, can't judge them, can't mentor them. There's a part of the book where there's a dean in Arkansas. And this dean created a bit of a Facebook sensation because he said, look, you parents out there, I confiscate these phones and I see the technology and the amount of vulgarity and sexuality and violence and filth that your 13 to 17 year olds are consuming for hours and hours and hours a day, it would shock you. And these young people are absorbing those kinds of norms in a way that I think the average adult just simply doesn't appreciate.
You call digital devices a legal narcotic. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean by that is we can't control ourselves. I feel this in my own life. Todd, I don't know if you do, but you know, if I'm standing in line at the bank, I take out my phone. Sometimes, you know, I will be at the dinner table and think I want to look something up, and I'll go look at my phone. You have all these, you know, we know now that our phones are designed, the social media is designed, all of this is designed so that, you know, whenever your device buzzes or it pings or you have a mention, it creates some endorphins in your brain. And I find it interesting that the people who design this digital world will not let their own children go in on it because they understand the extent to which we are completely taken with our devices. We can't get away with them. And it's almost like it's a key to an entirely different world. And in this world that we're in all the time, we're ignoring, especially the young people, we're ignoring the good stuff, going for a jog, going to the movies, making new friends, reading a book. And, you know, I talk a lot in the book, Todd, about how young people don't read anymore because their attention spans have been destroyed by videos that last 90 seconds or 5 seconds or meme after meme after meme, scrolling all day. It's really hard for young people to sit down and take the time to read a book. And so it is absolutely a legal narcotic. And just like a regular narcotic, it's making us sick.
Why can't our schools substitute for family and for community?
I don't think we should ever ask them to, even though I think we do. As much as I have a great deal of affection for my students, as much as I care about them, as much as I try my best for them, and I know almost all of my colleagues feel the same way, an educational institution, a school, a classroom, all of the trappings of an educational place just does not have the permanence of a family. And so teachers are not there when you're born, not there when you go away to college. We are a very, very temporary, ephemeral part of your life. And there's no way that we can fill in that void. Not only that, I think I read somewhere that between the ages of 2 and 18, you know, you spend 92% of your time not in school. So to expect 8% of your time of childhood to be decisive in a way that the other 92% are supposed to be, I think is unreasonable.
What is the most effective way to improve education?
Great question. And the most effective way, there is no magical elixir. There is no solution. Everybody, this is one of the things that really bugs me in our culture when we talk about education, is we think that there is a magical solution. But that is really a illusion itself. The bottom line is, the research is very clear. 90% of a student's educational outcome is dictated not by the school, not by the teacher. It's by the family. It's by the parents, it's by the community, it's by the value system and the habits that exist before a student comes into the classroom. Now, don't get me wrong, Todd, I'm an educational romantic. I do believe that teachers can alter the trajectory of a student's life for the better. And I've seen that happen hundreds, if not thousands of times. But if you're talking about a system-wide change, I think we have to be honest and say there is no one solution. We have to do better with the other 90%. Than focusing on the 10% that's happening in school all the time.
We're discussing Western civilization and American youth with Jeremy Adams, author of the new book, Hollowed Out, A Warning About America's Next Generation. Stay tuned. We're going to give away a copy of this book later in the interview. On the other side, what have we lost in forgetting the roots of Western civilization? I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned. Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. continues to rank among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast ChristNet on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Is your school or homeschool ready to take the next step in teaching students with learning challenges? We can help. The Simply Classical curriculum, voted number one for special learners, is available from Memoria Press for students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome. We provide everything you need for a full year. Use promo code LPR21 at simplyclassical.com. Simplyclassical.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming 3-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Wednesday, August the 4th, we're talking about Western civilization and American students. Jeremy Adams, author of the new book, Hollowed Out, is our guest. Jeremy, what have we lost in forgetting the roots of Western civilization?
Well, it's really hard to renew the values and the blessings of a civilization if you don't understand the ideas and the people and the events that created your civilization and your society. So the founding fathers, if you go read the Federalist Papers, you know, they're constantly referring to the Greeks and to the Romans and to the Enlightenment. And it's really important, and Lincoln, frankly, talks about this quite a bit as well, that if you're going to understand the values of your country, then you really have to understand why people argued for them in the first place, kind of understanding the genesis of democracy. Where did the idea of Republican, small r, Republican, come from? Why do we believe in free markets? Why did science come about? And why is science a good thing? Is free inquiry a good thing? Why do we treasure freedom of religion? Why do we embrace pluralism? All of these values that we have, we take them for granted. And it's important for every generation not just to understand what we believe as Americans, as classical liberals. What's more important is understanding why we believe in these values that make up Western civilization. And if you don't know the why, then you're more likely to not appreciate it, and you're more likely to change it, and you're more likely to make it so that we can't renew this extraordinary civilization that we have been born into.
What is juvenile indignation?
When I write about juvenile indignation, I write about the fact that I've noticed with my own children, to be honest, and also with a lot of young people, that you really can't tell them what to think or to believe. And by the way, I think it's okay, you know, to say you don't have to think this, you don't have to believe this. It's one thing to say, hey, kids, hey, children, you know, I believe that these are the right values, or this is the right way to look at something, and to expose them to that. But what we're seeing today is something, Todd, very different. What a lot of young people are arguing now is not that we are wrong, but that there is no right, that values are completely relative, that morality is not absolute. There's a kind of radical subjectivism in the souls of our young people where, you know, they would argue that, you know, adults don't know anything more than they do because there is no higher, there is no ultimate. And so for most of human history, young people look to adults for guidance, for wisdom, for mentorship, because we've read and experienced and seen things that young people haven't. And what worries me today is if you don't believe that there is a better way to live, if you don't believe in higher truths, if you don't believe in a good life and that there's a, you know, certain values and principles towards living that good life, then that's where you get juvenile indignation, a sense that you can't tell me anything because there is no better life.
How has radical individualism manifested itself in the family?
Oh, easy. The best example of that is, you know, families don't eat together like they used to. There's a whole section in my book about how, you know, we're hollowed out because we don't have these values that traditionally, and these behaviors and these relationships that we typically have. And the best example of this is the death of the family meal. If you look at how often families get together at night, and it can be, you know, any formation, just a mom, just a dad, just a guardian, it used to be primarily that a majority of Americans at night, you would eat together. You'd fix the meal, you'd sit together, you'd clean up. And what you see in the last generation is that is severely in decline. I used the term family dinner a few times in the last few years, and the kids just look at me like I'm crazy. And I say, well, how do you eat your dinner? And they say, well, we make our own food and then we go to our rooms and do what we want to do. And I say, well, where are your parents? And they say, well, they go to their rooms or they're watching TV or they're at work. And so you see this individualism pervading even the home when there are adults there. The adults are there, but they're not providing guidance. They're not creating a kind of connective tissue that is the foundation for a strong family. Just this week, I saw in the New York Times that David Brooks wrote a fascinating column about the fact that there's this new phenomenon in America where adult children are really feeling alienated from their parents. And that you see as Americans are getting older and older, so many of them are having weaker and weaker bonds to their families. And I think that is a telltale sign of radical individualism corrupting the family bond.
What is taking the place of Christianity in American life?
Well, I would argue that for young people, it's a kind of secular cult of the self. I write about this in Hollowed Out quite a bit, but throughout human history, human beings have gotten their orientation, their sense of themselves and from different places. I mean, religious people tend to look up to the heavens and say, you know, we're creatures of the Lord and our lives are not accidents. Sometimes the ancient philosophers said, you know, you need to use your reason to figure out the best life. And so look into the world, be reflective, be ethical. And then even people like Nietzsche and others have said, you know, look into the void of nothingness. And when you realize that there is nothing, you have to chisel the marble of life on your own to create meaning. But what we see here is young people aren't looking up, they're not looking out, and they're not looking down. They're looking into a mirror. And you see this idea that the only way to reach fulfillment in life is not through contribution, is not through chiseling your own meaning, is not through any kind of faith. It's through simply indulging in whatever your most recent desire is. And that's what I mean by this kind of cult of the self, that if I can simply do what it is I want to do, then I'll somehow be happy. And we all know that that's a path to misery.
On the issue of race, you point out that Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail sounds strange to young people today. Why is that?
It's interesting when you study Letter from a Birmingham Jail, because there's a, which I think is one of the greatest pieces of American political writing, right along with Civil Disobedience with a Thoreau. But there's this great line in it where he says, human justice occurs when it is squared with the law of God. And what's interesting is I've noticed that young people believe in political morality. They believe in capital J justice. They believe that there are laws and policies that are wrong, that violate some kind of cosmic rule of justness. And yet when it comes to individual morality, they are dogmatically relativistic, that there is no right and wrong when it comes to sexual behavior, that there is no right and wrong when it comes to your relationships, that everything really is just a matter of taste and preference. And so it's interesting because, you know, I would argue, Todd, that the real division in America today is between people who believe that there are objective truths, that there is right, there is wrong, and that human beings don't have the power or the agency to decide what is right and wrong. We have the power to obey right and wrong. We have the power and the will to live up to right and wrong, but we aren't the ones who make it. Right and wrong are beyond us. And yet for a lot of young people, they disagree. That they would argue that they are the ones who get to decide what is right and what is wrong. And what's really wrong is not when you act immorally, because there is no such thing as immorality. It's when somebody judges you for doing it. So it's this kind of weird situation where tolerance and indifference merge into one in the minds of young people.
How has the decline of family life and religious commitments led to a rise in political identity or people identifying themselves almost solely by their political viewpoints or party?
You know, if you go back to any part of human history, I would tell you that the things that tend to give us a sense of ourselves, our kind of horizon of identity, really haven't changed. I mean, human beings are human beings, and we tend to identify ourselves as being members of a family, as members of a community or a country, as believers in a certain religious tradition, as friends of certain people, as connected to institutions. For instance, I mean, I'm a father, I'm a husband, but I'm also a teacher at a school, and that institutional identity fills me. And so we have all these markers traditionally that give you a sense of your place in the world, you know, family, friendship, institutions, religions. But all of those things are in decline. And that's what I mean by hollowed out, is the things that tend to fill us in, our souls, our identity, our sense of personhood. Those things aren't there for an entire generation of young people. And as a result of that, you see this hollowing out effect. And so why is politics so toxic? Because in the place of these traditional anchors of identity, we've put politics front and center. And you see this in a variety of ways. It used to be that a lot of people wouldn't date somebody of a different religious background. Now they say, I don't want to date anybody who has opposite political opinions. It used to be that parents were just happiest their child found somebody to love. Nowadays, a lot of parents say, I will be disappointed if you marry somebody who's the opposite political party than we are. So it really is a toxic stew that you see in our political life.
We're talking about Western civilization and American students with Jeremy Adams. He's author of the new book, Hollowed Out, a warning about America's next generation. We'll talk about how our founders designed our system of government to prevent politics from becoming central next.
This fallen creation is bested by tornado, hurricane, flood, pandemic, and more. LCMS Disaster Response helps our congregations, their pastors, and other church workers to reach out to their members and neighbors with mercy which flows from Christ's altar. We offer quality volunteer training, help for congregational readiness and response, and disaster grant funding. To learn more, visit lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Truth, freedom, and vocation are the pillars of a Concordia University Chicago education. Through them, we form our students for lives of influence and service for the common good. This is the education American society needs right now. I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, and I invite you to visit us to discover what it means for truth, freedom, and vocation to become the pillars of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your will. Help us who rightly seat us.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Western civilization and American students with Jeremy Adams. He's a high school and college teacher. In 2018, he was the first classroom teacher inducted into the California State University Hall of Fame, and he's author of the new book, Hollowed Out, A Warning About America's Next Generation. You have observed that our system of government was deliberately designed to prevent politics from becoming central in our lives. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is, unlike the kind of aristocracies or the absolutism that you see in Europe, where people in a society were subjects, right? They were not citizens. And there was no division between the private and the public sphere of life. You had established churches, so you didn't get to choose your religion. You know, if you believed in the divine right of kings, then you were a subject of that king by writ of God himself. And so in America, we said, we're not going to do that. We're going to be a nation based on claims of individual liberty, where people can pursue their own dreams, define their own selves, live lives as they want to. And so we deliberately bifurcated our American life into the public sphere, right, which is, you know, where politics is. That's where we talk about public issues and laws and statecraft, and our private sphere. And the private sphere is where really the most important part of life is. deciding who you're going to love, where you're going to live, what your convictions are, what church you're going to go to, or if you're going to go to church at all, what institutions you're going to believe in and donate your time to. And so in America, we deliberately bifurcated that in our society. And yet, what you see today is politics has become so important to young people. And this is weird for me to say, by the way, because I'm a political science teacher, and so I want kids to be active in political life. But politics should not be the first, second, or third most important part of who you are, because what happens is the elections that you participate in become so important that when you lose, you feel like half of the country is trying to destroy your life. And that's just simply not the case.
That goes hand in hand with kind of a general politicization of everything, family, marriage, children, the virus, masks, everything becomes a matter of politics, and in some cases, no sense of proportion ensues. What are your thoughts there?
That's such an insightful statement. You're right, because when you exist in a paradigm where you see half of the country as the enemy, then literally every issue becomes magnified in its importance. And maybe I'm just being naive here, but I'd like to say that when I was a kid, I think that if we had gone through this, everybody, the vaccines would not have been politicized. I think a lot of the things that you see are emblematic of a toxic culture where politics is trying to fill a part of our spirit and our souls that it just simply cannot fulfill. You know, it's essentially junk food for the soul in the place of vegetables and good food. So I agree. I think that's one of the problems that you see in a decaying society.
Why does our Constitution, and this is an old observation, but John Adams saying it requires an ethical, a moral people, but why does it also involve require not only an ethical people, but also an informed people?
Well, that's the nature of our system. Right? We have a system. If you look at the Bill of Rights, I'm going to put on my political science teacher hat for a minute. You know, it's interesting. Young people are always kind of surprised when they look at the Bill of Rights, because the Bill of Rights is a bunch of statements about what government cannot do. It's a statement of the limitation of government power. And the spirit of that, this idea that we're going to have a limited government, that really speaks to the idea that we're not going to have a government-centered society, we're going to have a freedom-centered society. But if you're going to have a society and a government where the powers of government are limited, that means that the people have to be able to govern themselves. This is where I think a lot of Americans don't really understand the founders' view of religious freedom. I mean, the First Amendment is not there to make sure that everybody's one religion, and nor is it there to make sure that we have state-mandated atheism. The First Amendment is there to encourage a broad diversity of religious experience and belief, because there is something that most religions have in common, and that is a sense of moral rectitude being inculcated into the souls of people. And if you can govern yourself, if you can take care of your family, then you don't need a lot of police. You don't need a huge welfare state. And it's no coincidence that as people have not been able to govern themselves, government has had to grow to take care of them.
Why are American young people increasingly hostile toward America?
Well, I think it's two things. One, they don't know a lot about it. It's interesting. Sometimes you hear this term from young people nowadays that frankly annoys me a little bit when they're like, they say, well, you know, older people need to do the work. And I think what they're trying to say is, you know, you older Americans don't understand all of the really awful episodes in American history. And what I want to say is, yes, we do. For some reason, young people seem to think that they are the first generation sometimes to realize that we do have a really awful history in this country of a lot of bad things, about 200 years of slavery, 100 years of Jim Crow, the way that we treated Native populations, you know, a lot of our behavior in our treatment of Central America at the turn of the century, you know, realpolitik during the Cold War. Yes, there are a lot of things in American history not to be proud of, but older Americans look at that differently. Older Americans know all of that, but they say to themselves, because 94% of older Americans feel that we have a history to be proud of, older Americans look at all these episodes and say, look, the real America is not the one that did the bad things. It's the America that moved beyond it. That's the spirit of the country. So, you know, you might look at slavery and say, look at what America did. Why would we be proud of that? And older Americans would say, that's not where we ended up, though. Real America is the Civil War and the 13th Amendment. Real America is not segregation. It's Martin Luther King. It's the Civil Rights process. It's the Voting Rights Act. It's the 24th Amendment. And I think older Americans take pride at the fact that we have made so much, almost indescribable progress towards a more just and extraordinary civilization where the blessings of liberty are broadly shared and prosperity can be enjoyed by everybody. And they take pride in that. And I think young people sometimes look at the past and say, that is who we really are. And that division, I think, is very potent, and it's getting broader.
What's the danger of teaching American history that only focuses on America's ills and its past sins and not its strengths and, as you say, kind of a story of redemption?
Yeah, a story of redemption. That's well said. The problem is this, and this is where I am very worried about. Let me go back to your last question a little bit. Not only do a lot of young people look at, you know, what's worst about America and think that that's the essence of the country, the problem is that where do young people spend their time? On social media, on their phones. If you talk to young people and you say, well, what kind of view of the country do you get? And it is all negative, all the time. Cynical, jaded, pessimistic, aggrieved. So young people, I mean, your reality is what you consume. And so they don't know a lot about American history. What they do know is bad. And so what worries me is this. The United States of America is unique in the history of the world because we are what Lincoln called a propositional nation. We are not a nation held together by the traditional markers of nationhood. We don't have a monarch or a sovereign. We don't have an established church. We don't have a race or a language or a, you know, one small geography. We are a pluralistic nation held together by something. And if you ask most young Americans today, what makes an American, they have no idea. And the worry is, if you tell young Americans that what makes an American, which is, by the way, a belief, it's a proposition, it's a spirit, it's agreeing with natural law, it's agreeing that the purpose of government is to protect individual liberty no matter the circumstance of your birth. It's a belief in the universalism of justice. It's a belief in the Declaration of Independence and the 14th Amendment, right? We are a creedal nation. But if you tell young people that that creed is a lie or that it's a front for some form of malevolence, and they start to disbelieve the proposition America, I don't know what we have left to bring us together. That national motto we had, e pluribus unum, out of many we are one, all we're going to have is the many, and we're not going to have a one.
What did Ronald Reagan mean when he talked about the eradication of American memory?
What he's talking about there is the fact that Americans have to know their own story. America is a nation where values have to be renewed, and we have to understand why we believe in it, what we've done to renew it. And by the way, I mean, this is I think, not just Reagan's point and Lincoln's point in his Lyceum address in the 1840s, but the broader point is that young Americans are just simply unaware, many of them, that they are probably the luckiest human beings in the history of the world. If you had to pick a time and a place to be born, if you wanted to be free and have a chance at wealth and be able to say what you want to say and think what you want to think and go where you want to go and love who you want to love and not die in a war and enjoy the blessings of science and be able to select your leaders, I think a very strong case could be made that you would want to be born today, maybe not in America, but at least a Western liberal nation modeled after our values. And I think in order to have those blessings be extended, renew the institutions that created the success, rather than taking it for granted.
Finally, how can teachers help their students reject this defeatist determinism that you talk about in the book?
I think I even call it American fatalism. You know, and this is kind of a vogue, fashionable idea out there that Americans aren't in charge of their lives, that really these larger historical, impersonal power structures are deciding where you go and what you do. And it is the exact opposite of the American idea, which is about individual freedom and agency. And I think a person is naive if they think that some people aren't more privileged than others. They are. And I think that too many of our young people in this country today don't have opportunity. It is a very sad state in America where the number one predictor of poverty is if your parents were poor. So I'm not saying that there are not huge structural disadvantages that a lot of people have. But I think the worst way to deal with that problem is to tell young people that they are victims of their fate, that they don't have agency, that they don't have will. And the most important thing that a teacher can ever do beyond curriculum or anything else is to make sure that a young person knows that you believe that they can achieve. A year later, you might forget what's in the Federalist Papers. You might forget how to do stoichiometry in your chemistry class. But you will remember forever a teacher who believed that you could achieve things even if you didn't believe it yourself.
Jeremy Adams is a high school and college teacher. In 2018, he was the first classroom teacher inducted into the California State University Hall of Fame. And he's author of the new book, Hollowed Out, A Warning About America's Next Generation. You'll find a link to this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Jeremy, thank you very much.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Thank you for promoting the book.
Caller number 7 during this break will receive a free copy of Hollowed Out, A Warning About America's Next Generation. Call now, live this Wednesday afternoon, the 4th of August, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE, and you could win a copy of Hollowed Out, 1-877-623-MYIE. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller joins us next for part 12 of our series, What I Wish My Non-Lutheran Family Knew About the Bible.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
For nearly 140 years, the Lutheran Witness has taught the faith, defended it against error, and shown forth the great treasures of the Lutheran Church and biblical doctrine. We're continuing this legacy by publishing issues and articles that help you see the world from a Lutheran perspective and that teach biblical doctrine and show forth the treasures of God's Word. Visit our website to learn more and how to subscribe, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
When it comes to serving their neighborhood, what could two churches 2,400 miles apart have in common? Both Grace Lutheran Church in Blaine, Washington, and Christ the King in Memphis, Tennessee, are confronting homelessness in amazing ways. Their stories are inspiring and make you want to join in with them. Hello, my name is Rahema Kavuga of Lutheran Church Extension Fund, and I'm inviting you to check out these stories and more at interesttime.org. Great things are happening coast to coast, and you can be a part of it. That's interesttime.org.
Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas is now enrolling for the coming school year. What makes us unique? A confessional Lutheran school offering a classical education for preschool through the 12th grades. Faith Lutheran School features rigorous classes that incorporate a focus on wisdom, truth, virtue, and the historic Christian faith. Live online classes are also available for high school students worldwide. To learn more about Faith Lutheran School or to submit an application, visit flsplano.org. That's flsplano.org.